Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The aim of the Folklore Podcast is to bring quality folklore discussion and world-class guests to its audience completely free of charge. As such, we do not carry adverts and do not accept sponsorship. You tell us you prefer it this way. In return, we rely on your support to continue making episodes of the podcast. Without it, we cannot keep going. If you enjoy the Folklore Podcast, please consider clicking the donate button at thefolklorepodcast.com or signing up for a small monthly contribution in return for exclusive content and rewards at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. If you cannot help in this way, please share our episodes on social media and leave positive reviews for the podcast in your app of choice. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Today on the podcast we return to Iceland with another author to examine the history and folklore of a few hundred years ago. Caroline Lee grew up in Jersey and gained a first in English literature and creative writing from Warwick University. She went on to become head of English at a Birmingham grammar school before returning to Warwick, where she now lives, works and writes from. Caroline's novel, The Glass Woman, was published by Penguin Books in the UK in February and releases in the US very soon. It is set in an Iceland of 1686, a time when the superstitious population were haunted by the recent memories of witch trials, and examines the lives and trials of people in village communities at that time. It has been described as rich in superstition and mystery, and utterly unputdownable, and I would happily endorse those descriptions. I spoke with Caroline recently about the novel and her writing. Hello, Caroline, and welcome to the Folklore Podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Now, before we start, I'll just ask you, if you don't mind, as I do with all of the guests we have on the podcast, to just say a little bit about who you are and your background and what you do and what interest you have in folklore.
Sure. So I started writing quite some time ago after doing the creative writing degree at Warwick as an undergraduate. And I'd always wanted to write, but then ended up in teaching because I thought that would give me plenty of time to write because teachers have long holidays and start work at 9 and end at 3. but then ended up not writing my first book for quite some time. But throughout that, I'd always had sort of a fair amount of interest in folklore and fairy tales. I love the work of writers like Angela Carter and was sort of continually drawn to that. So from when I first started kind of writing for publication, I really wanted to write stuff that had, I suppose, a background and a landscape to the story that existed, that sort of to the story that that was working. So, I mainly write, and I write as much as I can, but I also now teach on the Warwick Creative Writing Programme as well. I worked in schools teaching for quite some time, but I'm mainly university teaching now. And it's just a juggling act. I've also got two small children. So, yeah, that's provides some sort of time constraint. But it's interesting because they come out with bits of folklore that I wasn't aware of, stuff that they picked up in school and things about Greek myth that I didn't know and I think was severely lacking in my education. And that that now, yeah, that drives kind of my interest even more. So that's always good.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple of strains to that, I guess, as well, isn't there? Because there's the syllabus study of mythology, which naturally has some folklore elements in it. But then there's very much a culture of playground folklore, an area that's been written about and studied at length by the late Opies. Iona Opie and her husband collected masses of playground folklore. So new stuff comes back from that all the time too, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That sounds brilliant. That sounds really brilliant. I haven't come across that. But I think the idea of kids are so open to thoughts about mythology and I suppose just readily believe stories and they're constantly telling each other stories. And there's kind of a natural feeling about so much of folklore and the way that it incorporates ideas about kind of the land that we live in and how we live, you know, how we live within it. And kids seem so much more open to that, I think, than we are. I think it's really easy as an adult to kind of close yourself off to anything that doesn't seem quite real and believable and to look at things like folklore as though they're some sort of abstract or something from the past. But there's so much folklore that's still present in, you know, in the society that we live in today and kind of beliefs and myths and urban myths, and we still like telling each other stories. So yeah.
Yeah, we really do. And that's precisely what you're doing through your writing, isn't it? And so today we're going to talk about your latest book, which is The Glass Woman, published by Penguin Random House. As I've said to you before this interview, thoroughly enjoyed this book. It still remains my book of the year so far. It's such a wonderful and evocative and fascinating story, and I hope this interview spurs lots of people to go and seek it out because it is absolutely fantastic. Now tell us, for those that haven't read it or don't know it, a little bit of a synopsis, no spoilers, as to what the book is about.
So The Glass Woman is set in 17th century Iceland, which I think for some people who might not automatically be interested in history and folklore sounds or could sound potentially off-putting. Other people, I think, are fascinated by the idea. But although it's a historical novel, I think lots of the concerns that I wanted to deal with, like the power balance in relationships between men and women and what we choose to believe in and how we end up sort of fearing things, I wanted them to be sort of universally kind of relevant themes that cropped up in the novel. So the protagonist is Rosa, and she's sort of forced through circumstances to marry a man who lives in a far-off village on the coast of Iceland, and so then has to leave kind of her safety and security and her mother who's unwell and marry this local Gordi, who's like a sort of like a chieftain in the village, who has kind of secrets of his own, and there's talk about his first wife and that she died and he sort of buried her. And there are kind of rumours about him, and he's quite an unsettling character, I think, for lots of the novel. But one of the kind of drivers behind my inspiration for it was, I suppose, the idea that everyone has a perspective on different events. And I wanted to tell Rose's story and Jon's, and to kind of explore the ways in which kind of conflict and to some extent like fear and marital breakdown or relationship breakdown, even when you, from your own subjective perspective, it feels very definitely kind of one-sided and clear-cut. There are always two sides to every story. There's a great proverb at the start that I've used at the start. Icelandic kind of folklore and everything is brilliant for proverbs, and it's a tale is only half told when one person tells it, and it's so very true. From you know, minor disagreements to things like marital breakdown, everyone has a side to the story. So yeah, it kind of focuses around that and deals with the superstition and the folklore of the landscape, because Rosa becomes increasingly terrified when the land and the place he's moved to are become horribly unsettling.
Now, this is a story that could have been told in a number of different ways, and stories surrounding marital breakup and relationships are not uncommon stories to tell. So why did you choose to travel firstly back to the 17th century and secondly across to Iceland in order to tell your version of this tale?
So I wanted a landscape where you could feel very sort of unsettled and isolated. I think that that place of kind of a relationship breakdown is such a frightening one, and particularly kind of at that time in the 17th century where women were so disempowered, and, you know, many people sort of lacked maybe the education to be able to kind of question beliefs. And so that even as like a maybe, well, the alternative to kind of the ancient beliefs and folklore that people were educated about was Christianity. And so it was, the 17th century was quite a time of conflict, I suppose, for religion versus folklore. And there's quite a lot of focus on the fact that Rosa's father was a reverend, and then her new husband is quite religious, but she herself like has absorbed ideas about folklore through her relationship with her mother. So she herself kind of embodies this duality and this awkward kind of space in history where people could believe one or two things, and increasingly outside influences, particularly from Denmark, which had a sort of increasing amount of control over Iceland at that point, the thrust is definitely towards Christianity and kind of cutting out the old ways and doing away with these traditions that really people had had believed for centuries, because the landscape is so raw and so wild. And so that was part of my decision, and obviously the landscape itself is so evocative, and so the idea of kind of being isolated anyway is, I think, I hope, intensified through the idea that when Rosa moves away from her family, she doesn't just move down the road. It's utterly impassable at times in Iceland, and if you went out into a snowstorm, you could disappear. You could be a few meters away from someone and just disappear. So I loved the idea of that evocative, beautiful, brutal landscape, and I think maybe because of that, you know, people sort of believe in things like the hill folk. And these kind of these spirits that live within the land and other forces that operate. And that was hugely appealing. And along with the Icelandic sagas, which I wasn't really aware of. And I don't know how I managed a degree in English literature without ever really being aware of the Icelandic sagas, because they're really fundamental. But they're some of the oldest stories really in Western literature. And they've got their, rather than being kind of these grandiose tales of heroism, that are enacted by gods and goddesses. Although the Icelandic sagas have elements of the supernatural within them, they're very much the stories of normal Icelanders, or, you know, maybe fairly powerful Icelanders, but for whom sort of magic events occur sometimes. So you'll have this story that's just richly steeped in kind of in this brutal environment, and you'll have sort of ghosts or trolls or the hill folk operating kind of within the story, and those forces of good and evil as a backdrop and a background to what could otherwise be an everyday story of your brother stole my wife. So I love that conflict between sort of the domestic and kind of the supernatural and the ideas of folklore that underpinned it.
Do you think as well that in some ways you're challenging the norms within the folklore within Iceland to one extent, and that is that in this book the Christianity angle is sitting quite firmly with John, I guess, as a main character, and Rosa is potentially seen to be to run the risk of being seen as a witch, and then you have another character in the book as well who is also you know, known for her healing and those sorts of wise woman type characteristics. Now, in Iceland, it was very much predominantly that men were seen as witches, if you like, more so than women in the folklore record. But the way you tell the story kind of almost inverts that. Was that a conscious decision?
I think I wanted to kind of use that to add to the idea of kind of the terrifying landscape that Rosa found herself, rather than necessarily sort of consciously inverting, because you're right that female witches is definitely sort of a kind of a European convention over here, and maybe through Germany, and the number of people who were burned for witchcraft in Iceland was actually only around 100, and there were very few cases of women who were burned, and usually they were outsiders. So I think there was one case up in the north of Iceland where there was a woman who'd and I kind of incorporated into the novel, there was a woman who was an outsider and had managed to survive a horrible snowstorm and reach this village safely. And as a result, she was accused of witchcraft. But primarily, I think, unlike in sort of over here, where it was easy to direct accusations of witchcraft against someone who was unsettling because they were sort of maybe fairly powerless or were outside of kind of the boundaries of the social sphere. So the stereotype is the woman who lives by herself and maybe has a cat and kind of seems independent and therefore doesn't seem to rely on the kind of patriarchal norms within the society and becomes therefore threatening and an easy scapegoat. And I think some of the same ideas were going on in Iceland, in that it was quite often that the accusation was levied at a man because he was threatening for different reasons. So generally, it was men who were educated, and at that time in Iceland, if you had if your cows got ill, or your sheep got ill, you were very much as likely, or lots of people were as likely to call a priest as to call sort of a man who might kind of cast a spell to bless or to get rid of the evil influence. And the two things kind of were fairly comfortably coexisted, but increasingly, sort of, as I said, as the religious influence grew, the suspicions that could be levied at men ran much higher. And the idea of like a man who was an outsider then in a society that was slowly knitting together under the influence of Christianity became more worrying. So at that point then, the educated man who's perhaps getting a bit too powerful becomes the threat, and in the same way that a woman might have been a threat here because she didn't quite operate within the norms that society had agreed on, a man who was too educated, too powerful over there could be accused of witchcraft, I think, for similar fundamental sort of underlying reasons. And that might be too much of a generalization. I'm not an historian who studied in any great depth, but that was some of the ideas that seemed to occur to me. And it worked quite well within the story because initially there are suspicions and there's constant threat of witchcraft that could be levied at anyone. And Jon is a powerful figure within the village. But I wanted that threat to hang over Rosa as well and Katrine. And just this idea that your existence is so tenuous and really you rely on, well, and particularly the women would have relied on the men who had power. And that position of power was something that people jostled for.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think you're absolutely right in the way that you treated it. It's evident from the way that you talk about it, and it's certainly evident from the text of the book, that you've put an awful lot of research into this novel in preparation for writing it. How did you go about researching an area that, by your own admission, as not being a historian, is not an area that you have studied for the whole of your career? How did you go about researching it? And during the course of that research, what kind of beliefs and traditions and things were thrown up that surprised you or that you had to look into more?
So it was the landscape and the folklore that initially drew me to that particular time period and to the country. And I, because I do love doing research, I then went and bought an awful lot of, I'm going to say books are never overpriced, but books of historical resource sort of research that have a limited print run.
They really are.
They're not cheap. They're not cheap. And I mean, perhaps if I lived in London, it would be easier and I could go and go and spend a day in a massive library. But my local library's resources of 17th century Iceland were very few. So I ordered a load of books on kind of society and kind of anthropology and beliefs at that point. And I spent quite a lot of time on Google and I tracked people down and emailed them. And I was lucky enough then, because I wrote my first draft before I went to Iceland, which I know sounds backwards. But it's actually, it was just because of timing. I've got two small children. I didn't have time to go and I was writing this novel. So I just thought, well, if there's gaps, I'll discover them as I travel. And actually, I would never do it any other way now. I think it just allowed me to focus my research really carefully. And it meant that I was really lucky because there were some professors from the University of Iceland who agreed to see me when I went over and spent an afternoon talking to me, and I had this just interminable list of questions about minor details or kind of major themes or kind of or big events at that point. And I was able to go, would this have happened? Could this have happened? Might this person have done this? And lots of the questions they gave answers to, and some of the questions they said, well, we don't really know, but aren't you writing fiction? Just make it up. And actually that was quite refreshing, because it is, it's a difficult line, and I think there are always going to be people who come to a historical novel and get annoyed because there's a flaw in kind of in the facts as they're presented. But I do tend to, I tend to sit in the camp where I feel like if it's fiction, I'm buying into the world of the novel, not to, you know, I'm not reading a history textbook. So I have taken some license with some things. But there were lots of brilliant pieces of folklore that came up. So some of them I've incorporated into the novel, some of them just didn't kind of make the cut or were too difficult to. So there's one which is in the novel, a belief that if you go to sleep under a birch tree, that you might kind of wake up and there could be a troll kind of sitting on your chest, and he will steal your soul in exchange for kind of gold that he might give you. So this idea, I suppose, of like of greed, maybe, and in the same way that we might use fairy tales to warn people against against straying off the path. I don't know if that's a cautionary tale to warn people against greed or to warn them against going to sleep under a tree when they should be doing something else. But I liked the idea anyway, and kind of myths about the mountains and the landscape that that lots of them were created by an enormous troll that had kind of sunk his axe into the land and it kind of separated it, and that then kind of lava still bubbled up out of the cracks. And that actually almost word for word was told to me by an Icelandic tour guide. And I was struck by the poetry in kind of in the language of so many of the Icelanders that I spoke to. And I think they have, I think I'm correct in saying, they have the highest proportion of writers and poets of any city in the world. And I don't know if that's education levels or this amazing landscape or whether it's kind of the way that they tell each other stories. And because these myths and legends and the folklore are still so present, so there've been kind of modern cases of roads that have been diverted because a little bit like in Ireland and the Celtic belief in the good people and the fair folk, there are the hill folk in Iceland, and you do stuff to keep them happy and you steer clear of their way. And if you know that they live in a particular rock or a particular hill, you just avoid it. So there was a successful petition to divert a road because otherwise it would have disturbed the dwelling of the hill folk, and then there would have been loads of car accidents. And I love the fact that this petition went through Parliament and people were like, well, yeah, actually, that's a good point. Let's divert the road. And then the one that I couldn't include, but I really loved, was have you ever heard of necropants?
Yes, I know all about those.
Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't heard of necropants, and I hadn't before I started doing the research, the idea is that these are your lucky pants, but your lucky pants are made of the leg skin of a dead man, And as long as you keep a coin in the pocket of it, which is made from the dead man's scrotum, you will always have good financial fortune. And I have to say, it's not something I'm willing to try, but I'd love to try it with someone at some point, obviously was. There are so many great beliefs.
There really are. That's okay. The Icelandic Witchcraft Museum is the only museum in the world, to the best of my knowledge, that has a genuine pair of necropants. Did you go and visit them when you were there?
Yes. And you can, for people who can't get across to Iceland, I think there are pictures available on the internet as well. And it's quite a sight. And it's quite, yeah.
It really is
striking. Yes, they've, and I think that's the thing. There's whole museums, and there's sort of dedicated to kind of past beliefs, and I love the fact that there's so many different beliefs, but that they're still so present. And I think that gives, in the same way that the land, there's something about the land that feels more exposed. There's something about that kind of landscape in the place that feels like being closer to something. I'm not religious, and I'm not particularly superstitious, and I don't personally really believe any of the folklore myself, but I do know that when you're standing next to a geyser that can shoot water kind of however many feet into the air, there's some sort of knowledge about the elemental force of the land that feels beyond, it's awe-inspiring. And I can absolutely see how, you know, hundreds of years ago people would have just been utterly in awe of it and totally, you know, taken over by the belief that there were spirits that operated outside of them and beyond them.
And these beliefs come up for very different reasons as well, of course. You mentioned the folklore about the birch tree there earlier on. And there are a number of aspects to that, I suppose, if you're looking at the greed angle and the morality tale, which is very, very common in folklore. But there's also the fact that in that particular story, the creature sits on the chest, and of course that draws from old hag phenomena and sleep paralysis folklore, and the concept in Scandinavian countries of the hug, which is a very similar supernatural creature as well. And those beliefs, of course, come from explanations of a medical condition that wasn't understood at the time.
So I had no idea Karen.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the case of the birch tree there, I think there are two or three different aspects to the folklore that have all joined together to make one story, perhaps.
And I wonder how, you know, it's so inventive and it says so much about a culture's storytelling. And when so many different cultures have, we make up stories to explain stuff that we don't understand. And medical conditions or things, you know, like things that we now understand used to be attributed to something supernatural. And quite often it was easy to demonize someone who had a particular condition that we didn't understand. But I quite like the fact that, you know, that the same tale can operate in a number of ways, like you said. So as a morality tale or as an explanation or perhaps as both.
Yeah, and in that case, I think it is both. And of course, you find that different cultures come up with their own versions of the same story. So if you go back to one of the earlier seasons of this podcast, there's a two-part episode on the incubus and the succubus and sleep paralysis and the old hag. And that looks at these stories and the way they're approached by lots of different cultures. And there are lots of similarities between them. And I think in that case, that's part of that tradition, probably.
I wonder if it's, and I always wonder this with beliefs that kind of track across different countries, and whether they've originated in one country and they've kind of been transferred through trade and through by word of mouth, or whether we simultaneously kind of develop these myths that have very similar kind of origins, and that they're actually, they spring up in different places at the same time. And I, much like, you know, sort of tool use was very similar in prehistoric times in lots of different areas, and you know, it's the same sort of question. Does language and belief travel in the same way that kind of that tools or technology might travel, or are we all kind of essentially programmed to generate these beliefs and stories?
Well, that's a key question, isn't it? There are two schools of thought there, I think. I know that my book on black dog folklore is sitting on your shelf to be read at some point. And when when you read that, this is an area that you'll see that I discuss in that book. And there are two very distinct angles. Certainly folklore travels where people travel, and it settles and adapts to the culture that the people are going to. So, for example, in the case of black dogs, I cite an example of during the times of slavery, when a lot of West Africans were taken to the Americas as part of the slave trade. They obviously then took their folklore and their stories with them, and they became embedded in the Americas. So you find examples, for example, in Texas of ghostly dogs, which follow the kind of themes from the African stories, where they're very much part of the family, because that was the route that those particular settlers took, whether they wanted to or not, in much unhappier times. But yes, the flip side is also true, and there's the idea of the collective conscious or the folk memory, and this kind of Jungian approach that we have these ideas embedded, rooted in our subconscious from our prehistoric ancestors, and that often we retell stories using tropes that come from times past without realizing how or why we do it. So I suspect there's probably a bit of both there.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I like the way that children as well, kind of, if you ask a child to tell a story, they seem to formulate something that has a very clear sort of, a beginning, an inciting incident, the problem and the resolution. And they do that kind of from a very young age, almost like we have this imprint of how stories work, and lots of kind of folklore myths and the tales sort of tend to be focused, or I noticed around Icelandic ones, would often be focused around a character and this thing had happened to them. Like every story that we recognise, where it sticks to this particular imprint. And I question how much we just have this desire to hear stories that have a problem and then a resolution. And it's kind of a source of fear and comfort, depending on what you need at that particular time.
Yes, that's right. It really is. There's a lot of fear and not so much comfort probably in The Glass Woman, certainly for a large part of it, because of the nature of the plot. You describe the atmosphere of the book yourself in other places as being gothic. It's gothic out of the time of gothic, but that description I think is very fair. Did you consciously do that, or do you think that is reflective of the beliefs and the traditions of the people about whom you were writing?
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious decision at all. I was told by my editor after she had read the draft, and she was very positive about the novel, and she was like, this is a gothic novel. And I was like, oh, is it really? So I think it did just emerge, out of the things that I'm interested in, the folklore, the darkness that exists within those belief systems and within the landscape. And I think there are lots of, within folklore, there are lots of elements of gothic. You know, there's the elements of the supernatural and the idea of fear, and quite often they're set in places that are a little bit weird so landscape quite often plays a big part. I think folklore and an interest in belief systems fits quite well with gothic fiction, and stuff that I've written since has the same. I'm not setting out, I don't sit down and kind of think I'm going to write a gothic novel, but everything I write seems, well, it's what I'm drawn to, it's what I'm interested in. And so I stick to kind of similar themes, and the stuff that I write as a result, I'm told is gothic, which I love the idea. I like sort of fiction that, although I'm a bit of a wimp, but I like fiction that has that kind of unsettling feeling and that sense of uncertainty, and people trying to look for answers and their place in the world. And quite often I think that is a process of fear, and ultimately, hopefully in some way you get some sense of safety. And I think that's you know, Gothic fiction has those origins too. I think people used to quite often read Gothic fiction to be scared and then to be reassured, in the same way that nowadays people read psychological thrillers to see, to watch society falling apart and then ultimately at the end order being restored. It's like, it's one of those comforting stories again, where we read stuff to escape our reality and to find someone whose life is somehow worse and more terrifying than ours. But then at the end, everything is hopefully to some extent okay.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Psychological thrillers, that's an interesting, I'm just going to pick up on that for a moment. Now, my guest on the last episode of the podcast was an Icelandic author. And that was Ursa Sigurdardóttir. Do you know her work particularly?
I've never read any of her stuff. I've got her, some of her stuff on my shelf to read, but I know that that she's really widely read and widely admired, and that her stuff has quite a lot of kind of elements of fear, and there's quite a lot of really dark fiction that and dark stories that come out of Iceland.
Yeah, there really
what
are.
Were her thoughts on that?
So she we talked about some various elements of Icelandic folklore, and you're absolutely right. I mean, she cited the fact that Icelandic folklore was particularly dark, and she talked about Christmas folklore, for example, which is very dark in Iceland. Fun and dark at the same time. So she uses, as you do with this book, various aspects of Icelandic belief and Icelandic lore in her writing, because that's the nature of the country in which she lives and in which you have both written about. But the difference with hers, of course, is that they're set in the modern day, and they are also crime or thriller stories as a genre, rather than yours, which you describe as being an historical novel. But other people have described your book as being a crime novel. So how do you reconcile those two? Do you see what you've written to be a crime novel in that way?
It's difficult. I went I was at Noirland, which is in Northern Ireland, and it there were lots of brilliant crime writers there, and they were talking about kind of about crime as a genre, and the audience members had gone along to a lot of talks, and then came along to mine with a couple of other writers, and we were talking about Gothic fiction and crime, and one of the audience members was a bit affronted and said, but Gothic fiction isn't crime. And I have problems with genre anyway, because I kind of think it's a difficult way of pigeonholing books, and it's very useful for booksellers in some senses in terms of knowing where to position a book. Or I suppose if someone comes in and asks for a book because they've liked something, genre becomes useful in that sense. But I'd hate the idea that genre became this limiting thing where you only ever read one particular type of fiction. So I do think that however kind of fashionable or unfashionable it might be, and actually I think it can be a dangerous thing to straddle two genres. But I do think that I didn't necessarily, again, set out to write anything that sat within the crime genre, but I knew that there was going to be some messed up stuff happening in it. And I knew there would be darkness in it, and I knew there would be death in it. But it perhaps doesn't follow some of the conventions of very definitely kind of genre crime fiction, where almost you, with some books, and some people, again, they find enormous comfort in it. You approach the book knowing the structure that you would expect. And The Glass Woman definitely doesn't fit that. It definitely is historical in that it's set in the past. But historical fiction, again, a little bit like sci-fi, and a little bit like a lot of sort of genre fiction, the term can almost sometimes, I think, be used critically and can kind of create an idea of something that's somehow stuffy and set in the past and inaccessible as a result, or overly affected with behaviours that perhaps you don't recognise because they belong to a different time. And I didn't want, and I never want any of my work, although everything I write tends to be set in some point in the past currently, I never want any of my work to feel like that. So because I think, as I said at the beginning, I do think that the concerns that we deal with in our emotional landscape, if you like, is the same and it remains the same, you know, in the same way that those belief systems in Iceland, you know, in Icelandic folklore have remained the same over time and we kind of carry them with us. And just as you were saying about other folklore beliefs, we carry those ideas and those beliefs with us, and our, you know, our emotional responses to things and our fundamental desire to believe in something or to answer questions is still the same. So I didn't want anything that's sort of that was historical to feel somehow remote, and I hope it doesn't.
No, not at all. I don't think that I would be comfortable pigeonholing the glass woman into any genre, be it historical or crime or anything else. At the end of the day, I think it is a novel that is set in our past, and that's really all that you can say about it as a categorisation. You said earlier that you were not superstitious or didn't particularly take any of these beliefs yourself. Do you think that's true across the board, or do you think that actually you do things in your daily life that could be seen as being superstitious or being older beliefs, but you just don't realise that you're doing them?
Who's told you? I think I tell myself that I'm not superstitious because I have a horribly overactive imagination. And at times, when I was a kid, I believed in everything and all things and was terrified of all of them. I mean, I'm that person who went to see The Woman in Black and then I couldn't go outside when it was dark. And sometimes, if I thought about it beforehand, I couldn't go outside when it was light for quite some time. So I think, although I am superstitious, I will feel I won't walk under a ladder. I tell myself it's just because that's sensible, but I won't do it. I broke a mirror the other day and was cursing, and it's a piece of glass. Why should I bother? But then I made myself keep the broken mirror. It was one of those two-sided ones, because I told myself this is silly. It's a superstition. It doesn't matter if I keep the mirror or not. But I'm slightly uncomfortable about it. I might go and throw it away after I finish talking, actually.
Maybe you should listen to the podcast episode all about mirror folklore before you decide what to do with it.
Okay. I'll go back and listen and get some advice from it. So I think we do, we're so desperate to find things to believe in, and I think, I don't say that in any kind of derogative way. I do think there is something more within all of us in terms of, you know, at a psychological and chemical level, just our awareness of self and our awareness that we exist within time and space and our consciousness, if you like, that makes us look for something beyond just ourselves. So we see ourselves as kind of our stories as having more significance. And therefore, I think quite often other stories have more significance as well. And we do look for meaning. And I think I did go through a phase where I was very religious. I was an atheist growing up, and then I became horribly sort of indoctrinated. It was borderline sort of cultish, really frighteningly so, for a few years, and then rejected it out of hand. And so I know that that desire for belief is within me, but I tell myself that I don't believe in things because I find the idea of actually choosing to believe, particularly in folklore, really quite disturbing. And I do sometimes, after I do my research, have to then not think about the things that I've found, because some of it is really highly disturbing. If you sort of, well, I wouldn't, for instance, do a bit of research and then go out for a long walk in the dark. So I think most people are the same. I don't know, maybe I'm making too much of a sweeping generalization. But you know, these myths and belief systems are universal. Every culture has their folklore, and that's got to be because, again, people have a similar kind of desire for something.
Yeah, they do, but not all folklore is dark either, and you just I suppose you naturally latch on to the darker elements because
what I gravitate towards, yes.
Whereas in fact, there's plenty of folklore which is the opposite of that as well. And, you know, lots of areas of folklore have their dark side and their lighter side or their protective side. And it's just how you choose to interpret it, I suppose. Finally, the title of the book, we must just address that before we go. The book is called The Glass Woman. Now, The Glass Woman, in physical terms, is a little token which Rosa carries in her pocket for a large proportion of the book. Tell us a little bit about The Glass Woman.
So I wanted Rosa to have something that that was more akin to ideas about superstition, and less that had less association with the newer Christian religion that was coming in. I knew I wanted to be more connected to the land, partly because then when things do become darker and more frightening in the novel, they seem darker and more frightening to her because she believes in them so strongly. So I didn't want her to carry something like a crucifix or any kind of religious symbol. I definitely wanted it to be something that could be associated with other elements. But I did think about, I mean, there are rune stones that feature kind of prominently in the novel, and she has one of those at some point. But then it felt almost like it would be tying her too closely to a very particular meaning or a very particular idea. And I wanted her to be able to change. So I suppose The Glass Woman became something like my own bit of folklore that I added in the novel. And she almost kind of believes, believes that it represents her, or it comes to represent her in some ways. And that initially, because it's a gift from her husband, it seems to represent something that's fragile or inaccessible or more perfect than she will ever be. But as she sort of develops as a character and as she strengthens throughout the novel, it perhaps comes to represent something else. And so I wanted an object to which I could ascribe my own meaning and to which Rosa could ascribe meaning and to which the reader could find something. I know that the readers have messaged me saying, what is the glass wall? What does it represent? In some ways, I don't want to give an answer because it doesn't really matter what I think it represents. I mean, I know I wrote the book, but I very much believe that once I've written it, it's open for interpretation. And I would be very happy. I would love the idea if a reader sort of came up with an interpretation that I hadn't thought of, but they found within the novel. I think texts in that way continue to be living things. It's the reason why we still find meaning in Shakespeare so many years on. It's the reason why we still find folklore so fascinating, because we take our modern belief systems and we imprint them on something and change its meaning, or find some way of connecting with past beliefs. That was The Glass Woman and the idea, really.
Yeah, that really is a very good example of why folklore is so interesting and so important, I guess, in equal measure. Caroline, this has been a fascinating interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about the book. If people want to go and find The Glass Woman to read it for themselves, and I, as I said at the top of this interview, I really suggest that you do, because not only is it a great read, but there are a lot of aspects of folklore in there that we didn't even touch upon in this interview. The runes, which you mentioned very, very briefly, ritual, superstition, yes, healing, all sorts of aspects which we haven't covered. This book is available in all good shops, all good bookshops, and undoubtedly a lot of bad ones as well. Also also online in all the usual sorts of places. Where would you, as an author, like people to go and seek out this book?
I'm a massive supporter of independent bookshops. I'm very lucky to have two brilliant independent bookshops very close to me. Kenilworth Books, which is just wonderful, and Warwick Books, which is brilliant as well. And so I would go to one of those. If you don't live near Kenilworth and Warwick, please find your local independent bookshop. I'm a big believer in trying to support bookshops. And if there isn't an independent one, then obviously the larger bookshops are equally in need of your support. Yes, that would be my that would be my place to go.
Excellent. Thank you. Kenilworth Books, I just as a sideline, follow them on Twitter because they do so much for authors and writers and all sorts of things. They really are.
They held an event for me and they made Icelandic biscuits. It was amazing.
Well, you can't have an event without biscuits, and to have Icelandic ones at yours would be even better. What's next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
So my next novel is set in Orkney and plenty of folklore in there too. And it's currently called The Metal Heart. And I'm not sure of publication date at the moment, but there will be a publication date at some point, I'm sure. But yes, I'm very excited about that. And I'm also sort of in the early stages of drafting the next one, but I spend a lot of time, I don't write very economically, I write very quickly and very badly and then spend a lot of time redrafting. So I'm in the process of writing quickly and badly at the moment.
Excellent. I'm sure it's not as bad as you think it is. Everything that we write as authors is always worse to us than it is to anybody else.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. Orkney is hugely rich in folklore. Mm. And there are some great websites as well, which discuss the folklore of Orkney. And you could do far worse as well than follow Orkney Library on Twitter while we're talking about people to follow on Twitter.
Because they're brilliant and hilarious.
They have one of the best library Twitter feeds out of all the libraries that I follow.
It's so good. Yeah.
It is hilarious. So follow Orkney Library. Let's just throw that one in as well.
Definitely do.
if people want to find out more about you and your writing, where should they go?
So I'm on Twitter. My handle is @CarolineLee. That's Lee twice. And I have a writing page on Facebook, so which is Caroline Lee Writer, I think. And I think the book itself is Googleable. You can find information on the Penguin website as well.
And do you have your own website?
I do not have my own website. No, the idea of having to maintain and write something else fills me with horror. I'm sure at some stage I will have to do it, but I'm resisting at the moment because, yeah, I'm stubbornly sticking to writing the books and not a website.
Yeah.
I should perhaps back this.
Your readers will be very pleased that you're concentrating on the books. Your publishers will also be very pleased, but they will also at some point make you do lots of other things as well, because publishers are very good at doing that.
I'm sure.
Caroline, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and to talk about your book. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant. Thank you, Mark.
My thanks to Caroline for talking about The Glass Woman. Do visit the podcast website and follow the links from this episode to get a copy of her book. Author interviews have been proving very popular with listeners to the podcast, and I have received a number of books recently for review and discussion, so do look out for more of these sorts of interviews coming up soon. Thanks for listening. See you next time. The Folklore Podcast is written and presented by me, Mark Norman. To find out more about my research and writing, visit www.facebook.com/MarkNormanFolklore. Or on Twitter with the handle @Mr_Mark_Norman. Research assistance is provided by Tracy Norman. Visit her website at www.tracynormanswitch.com to follow her historical research and projects. The Folklore Podcast will always be free to listen to and tries to avoid annoying advertising or sponsorship messages, but it cannot sustain itself. We are grateful for the support of all of our patrons who, for as little as $1 a month, earn themselves great rewards whilst ensuring our future. For more details, please visit www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. If you cannot support us in this way, please share the episodes on your social media and leave positive reviews. This really helps the audience for the podcast to grow. Visit www.thefolklorepodcast.com for more episode and guest information, to buy from the web store, or to sign up for free newsletters or get in touch. The Folklore Podcast theme music was written and performed by Gurdy Bird. Thanks for listening.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.